This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says elites in the Muslim world have a key responsibility in pressuring their governments to sever all ties with Israel. Israel's relentless strikes take more civilian lives across the Gaza Strip, with the total death toll from the regime's genocide exceeding 27,300. Also in the headlines, a senior Yemeni official says Sana'a will continue to support the Palestinian people, despite airstrikes carried out by the U.S. and the U.K. against Yemen. Good to have you with us. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says the elite in the Muslim world have a day or a duty, that is, to push their governments to sever ties with Israel. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei says enemies are trying to prevent the elite from taking up their growing role in the society in this regard. The leader also says negligence of the elite would result in heavy blows to the nation. Ayatollah Khamenei made the remarks during a meeting with Air Defense Force commanders. The meeting comes ahead of the anniversary of a key event before the fruition of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. On February 8, 1979, and 3 days before the victory of the revolution, Iran's Air Force staff met with the founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, in Tehran. Iran says the attacks by the U.S. and Britain on regional countries are clumsy attempts to avert people's minds from the ongoing Israeli genocide in Gaza. The foreign ministry spokesman said in his weekly presser that Washington is clearly trying to give Israel free rein in continuing its genocide against the Palestinians. Nasser Kanani added that the U.S. and Britain claim they do not want any escalation in the region. However, he said that their attacks on Yemen, Iraq, and Syria, and their support for the Israeli genocide disprove such claims. Kanani also said Washington and London prefer to choose Israel over peace and stability in West Asia region. The spokesman noted that the only sustainable solution to the current crisis in the region is ending the Israeli genocide in Gaza. Meanwhile, the Israeli bloodshed continues unabated in Gaza as more Palestinians have lost their lives in fresh air and artillery strikes on the besieged strip. At least 30 civilians were killed in Israeli shelling in the central city of Deir al-Balah during the past 24 hours. There was also a drone attack on an area in the center of Gaza City, which claimed the lives of 3 people. Elsewhere in that city, 4 Palestinians were killed after a residential building was bombed. According to a European NGO, roughly 110,000 Palestinians have been reported killed, missing, or injured in Gaza since Israel launched its bombing campaign on October the 7th. The EuroMed Human Rights Monitor also says around 90% of the entire population of Gaza has been displaced in almost 4 months. The death toll from Israel's genocidal war stands at over 27,000. A Palestinian doctor held in an Israeli jail for 45 days recounts the ordeal that he had to go through while in detention.
The torture was very severe in Israeli prisons. I am a doctor. My weight was 87 kilograms. I lost more than 25 kilograms in 45 days. I lost my balance. I lost focus. I lost all feeling. We were shackled for 45 days, handcuffed for 45 days.
The Palestinian physician says that he was subjected to abuse during his captivity, including sleep deprivation, starvation, constant shackling, and blindfolding. Sayyid Abdulrahman Maruf, who has been released now, says that his hands were cuffed, his legs shackled, and his eyes masked for the nearly 7-week imprisonment. The doctor says that he was working at a Gaza hospital when it was surrounded by Israeli forces in December and he was detained. He says one would not know the severity of the ordeal unless they went through it. The Yemeni deputy foreign minister says that the country will continue its support for Palestine despite attacks by the U.S. and Britain. Hossein al-Azzi and Yemeni armed forces will respond to attacks on the country's soil. He explained that such attacks are aimed at protecting Israel's ongoing genocide in the Gaza Strip. Al-Azzi also rejected the U.S. claim that Yemeni strikes are a threat to international shipping. He said it was the U.S. that militarized the Red Sea. Iran's foreign minister has condemned rounds of U.S.-led attacks on Yemen, Iraq, and Syria, warning against escalation in the region. In a social media post, Hossein Amir Abdullahian wrote that he had told his British counterpart that the continuation of the war is not a solution. The top Iranian diplomat was referring to heightened tensions in the region, over the ongoing Israeli onslaught on Gaza. Amir Abdullahian warned the U.S. and the U.K. not to test, quote, the wrath of the region. He added that the security of Iraq, Syria, Yemen, and Palestine equals the security of the entire region. The latest aggression by American and British forces against Yemen has also drawn condemnation from Palestinian resistance movements. Hamas warned that the attacks will plunge the region into further turmoil. And the Islamic Jihad movement holds the U.S. responsible for the repercussions of its attacks on Yemen.
A new round of airstrikes was launched by the U.S. and U.K. on Yemeni capital Sana'a and other cities. Yemen's army said in a statement a total of 48 airstrikes targeted the cities, stressing that the attacks will not go unanswered and unpunished. U.S. officials claimed that the airstrikes targeted military sites used by the Yemeni army in its operations in the Red Sea in support of Palestinians.
The United States is living in a state of hysteria as it believed that the war in Gaza would last only weeks, but today it is in its 4th month and Israel has not achieved anything in Gaza. America also did not achieve anything with its airstrikes that targeted the resistance forces, and thus its attacks against Sana'a was an attempt to terrorize the Yemeni army, but it did not achieve anything on the ground.
Yemen's Ansarullah officials vow to confront the Western escalation with the broader operations, emphasizing that their forces still have significant options at their disposal.
The brutal attacks against our country without any justification give us and our army the right to self-defense. American and British warships will be targeted wherever they are, and the Yemeni army's operations may expand to other places. This is up to the country's armed forces, which will decide how to respond.
In response to U.S. and U.K. aggression against Yemeni territories and the ongoing Israeli atrocities against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, the Yemeni army has intensified its naval operations. Over the past week, Yemen's armed forces conducted 10 operations targeting American and British vessels in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden.
Observers say the joint U.S. and U.K. operations against resistance movements across the region are intended to divert the international community's attention from Israel's genocidal war in Gaza. However, Yemen's armed forces have made it clear that they will retaliate against those who violate Yemen's sovereignty. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Iraqi resistance forces have targeted a U.S. base inside of Syria as they continue their operations in support of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. The Islamic Resistance in Iraq announced that its fighters struck the American base in the Al Omar oil field in Syria's Deir al-Zor province. There was no immediate word on possible casualties or damage. Iraqi resistance fighters carried out more than 100 attacks on U.S. military bases and facilities in the region in response to the ongoing American-Israeli genocide in Gaza. The Islamic Resistance in Iraq says its attacks are part of a strategy to counter U.S. occupation forces in Iraq and Syria and Washington's support for the Tel Aviv regime. Tension between Hezbollah and Israeli forces persists along the southern border of Lebanon. Hezbollah says its forces have targeted more Israeli settlements. Mayim Saleh in Beirut joined us earlier to give us an update on the story.
72 settlements have been targeted by Hezbollah. 22 settlements, have been targeted 72 times. And the border posts for the Israelis, the military posts specifically, we're talking about 45 posts, have been targeted 670 times. And there are also the backup posts that are even beyond the border. We're talking about some 19 posts. They were targeted 61 times. But you also have a huge number of those who left that area. Many of the settlers, some 81,000 settlers have left that area. Of course, the Israelis have transformed the entire Galilee region into a closed military zone where there's only the presence of soldiers. This has made it easier for Hezbollah to make their targeting only based and limited to military targets, and this is why they have mostly targeted soldiers as well. Of course, they've also targeted at least four logistic vehicles, in addition to 28 big armored vehicles that are used to transport soldiers, as well as 24 tanks, to even factories that are military, part of the Israeli military industry, which is very strong in the northern part, and that has also led to an economic loss when it comes to their military.
We'll be right back.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Multiple political factions in Iraq are demanding the withdrawal of the U.S. forces from the country's territory. Factions say that this is in line with the parliamentary ratification that called on all foreign forces to leave Iraq. The country first deputy parliamentary speaker says the ratification should be promptly implemented. The popular mobilization units have also called on the government to defend the national sovereignty and dignity. The PMU chief says this is done when Iraq is purged of all foreign presence. Meanwhile, the Islamic Resistance in Iraq says it will continue military operation against the U.S. until American forces pull out of the West Asian country. The developments come after U.S. and British forces launched airstrikes on western Iraq on Friday. The attacks killed at least 16 people and wounded 36 others. Habiba Jaguri is a journalist and activist who joins us from Adelaide, Australia. Welcome to the program. You know, we're taking a look at the way that, first of all, the U.S. is acting very provocatively when it comes to the military strikes, because hitting 85 targets or so is rather large in terms of inflaming not only the country of Iraq, but also the region as a whole, which Iran's foreign minister has said. But what it amounts to is the violation of Iraq's sovereignty, and in turn, you have again calls, which have not obviously been heeded by the U.S., for the U.S. forces altogether to leave the country. Do you think that this spells the end of it, based on what has occurred, of U.S. forces to leave the country?
Thank you for having me. I think this is a sign of the U.S.'s desperation, and it's losing in the region, entire region of the Middle East, especially in Iraq and Syria. The U.S. has had a history of violating these countries' sovereignties, whether it was the 2020 strike in Baghdad that killed Iran's General Qasem Soleimani, or it was during the illegal occupation invasion under the pretext of chemical weapons after 9/11. And right now, it knows that Israel is losing desperately. So it is retaliatory of them to save face, to come and strike against bases in Iraq and Syria. Iraq and Syria are countries that have every single right. The Islamic Resistance has every single right to launch and conduct military operations against the U.S. The U.S. knows that it cannot take on Iran as a whole. The U.S. knows this. That's why they would never dare to touch Iran. But they are big with their threats. They come out with their PR. The president, Joe Biden, comes out and says that they plan to seriously retaliate and look after any American that is harmed in the region, after lying and saying that they do not wish to escalate conflict in the Middle East. But this is also a lie. As we know, the case of Shireen Abu Akleh, who was Palestinian-American, of Rachel Corrie, who was American citizen, fully killed by Israel, but there has been no justice or retribution. The U.S. thinks that it has the right to be there. This goes back to its global arrogance. It goes back to its hegemonic delusions. However, it's really great to see that the resistance is striking back, and it's good to see that the U.S. is failing as a country.
One of the reasons for the attacks on U.S. interests by the resistance factions as a whole from Iraq and Syria has been U.S.-Israeli genocidal war in the Gaza Strip. That's just one of the reasons where there was an uptick from October 7th up till now in terms of targeting the U.S. interests, let's say. And there is a very strong belief that if the U.S. and Israel in turn stop this genocidal war, that the region would be relieved of the tension that exists. But it doesn't seem like the U.S. wants to do that, and it continues with this militaristic approach. Why do you think the U.S. Doesn't want this genocidal war to stop? Is it to detract maybe from the Israeli defeat, perhaps, on the ground? I'm guessing now. Of course, your opinion matters.
I think the U.S. looks after its capitalist economic interests, which is to plunder and exploit the resources of other countries, whether that be oil, whether that be uranium, their uranium. They care about profit more than people. They care about their military industrial complex and the profits that they bring in more than the welfare of their own citizens, let alone world peace. So the U.S. backs and supports Israel on a military and diplomatic basis because it wants influence and power in that region. It wants to have access to Syria's resources. It wants the governments in that area to serve in the interest of the U.S. rather than its own people in their own region and in its independence. However, it's great to see that the people are fighting and resisting back.
it's good to see that there has been a shift in the Western narrative, especially from Western countries after the ICJ ruling, that yes, South Africa's case against Israel committing genocide in Gaza passed and went through. This has put pressure on the US. This has made people question, this has made people realize that actually accountability matters, that their own government's complicity matters. I personally think that the US also needs to be taken into the ICJ, not just for genocide, but war crime after war crime, violation of human right after human right. Like we're speaking about today, the strikes in Syria and Iraq has violated the country's sovereignty. The US continues to do this to prove somewhat that it is a global power, even though that is fastly becoming false. And fastly, the US is a sinking ship. It is a Titanic. But it also cares about plundering resources. It wants access to oil pipelines. It wants access to oil and gas sites. It wants access to uranium. It wants access to everything.
Okay. Very well. We have Muslim Salem, our correspondent, now joining us from Baghdad. Muslim Salem, welcome. So tell us what has occurred in terms of the strikes. What are we looking at in terms of the anger that is now, focused squarely on the Americans and their presence? And we know that Iraq is coming out of a day of mourning for what occurred.
Well, we all know that the existence of these military forces are based on the agreement between Iraq and the U.S., the security and military agreement in which the U.S. provides military consultation and air cover to the Iraqi army. This is on paper. But these forces, looking at the recent, events and the recent attacks, show differently, a total different objective by attacking the Iraqi anti-terror forces. Now, and especially by looking to the recent attacks in specific, and when it comes to the rise of readiness, and when it comes to the army, to the U.S. Army, when in ground and air forces after the latest attack on Tower 22 in Jordan, this shows that the U.S. even plans on more operations against Iraq and Syria. So it really shows the objective of these forces and its existence in the region by increasing, military readiness. Even putting more risk at the region and even destabilize the security in the country, honestly, because when you attack anti-terror forces, this will definitely, and we all know, and it's been said by a lot of military experts, it will open doors to takfiri groups to conduct operations against Iraq. Now this comes in times where the Iraqi government is even pushing forward to set a timetable and to schedule the withdrawal of these forces, when the response of the American government was, and I quote, setting a committee to assess the ability of Iraqi army to face the Takfiri group, to face Daesh, and to have, military and strategic readiness to stand by itself, in which the Ministry of Defense clearly announced its readiness and it can face all these terrorist groups to save the country's stability and save the country's, land against these forces.
All right. Thank you very much, Muslim Salem, there, correspondent from Baghdad. Habiba Jaghouri, journalist and activist from Adelaide, Australia. Thank you to you also. With that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in. And that is with this additional World News. Thanks so much for being with us. Bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The UN agency reported that many of the Gaza amputees underwent the procedure without anesthetic. According to UNICEF, over 1,000 children in Gaza have limbs amputated. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, more than 1,000 children in Gaza have had one or more limbs amputated since the Zionist regime's onslaught on the besieged area began on October 7th, with many undergoing the procedure without anesthetic, the United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, revealed recently. James Elder, a UNICEF spokesperson, reported that children in Gaza were enduring 10 weeks of hell, and not one of them can escape. Elder, who has recently returned from the besieged enclave, reported that the few remaining hospitals in Gaza are overwhelmed with children and their parents, all of whom are bearing the ghastly wounds of war. He said that many of them were child amputees. He said, as a parent of a critically sick child told me, our situation is pure misery. I don't know if we will make it through this. Due to the total blockade imposed by the Zionist regime on the enclave and a dearth of anesthetic, electricity and running water, health workers are forced to perform these surgeries in unhygienic conditions without painkillers. It's not as if there is a natural disaster preventing anesthesia from entering Gaza, Palestinian Children's Relief Fund PCRF founder Steve Sesbi said in an interview with Democracy Now. He said, it's absolutely unimaginable that this is happening in our modern world. He added that the number of child amputees were likely to grow because a lot of these kids have significant injuries that mean they will need amputations in the coming weeks and months. He added, not only were they amputated without anesthesia, but many of them were amputated in a very quick fashion. Around half of my operating list, which was around 10 to 12 cases every day, were children. Dr. Ghassan Abousita, a London-based surgeon who traveled to Gaza to treat patients amid the ongoing Israeli onslaught, said in a press conference in November. One night at Al Ahli Hospital, I performed amputations on 6 children, he recalled. In an interview with Middle East Eye, Sita said that having to perform these operations without anesthetic was one of the most difficult things I've had to do in my career. Prior to the current war on Gaza, 12% of Palestinian children aged 2 to 17 faced one or more functional difficulties, while 21% of households in Gaza include at least one member with physical or mental disabilities. According to PCRF, prior to the current hostilities, Gaza was already suffering from amputee crisis. The ongoing Israeli siege on the enclave, which tightly controls the flow of people, medical equipment and pharmaceuticals in and out of the area, means timely evacuation of the wounded to better-equipped hospitals in the occupied West Bank is often impossible. The barriers to healthcare access are such that the UN defined individuals in need of medical referrals as a vulnerable group within the Palestinian population. According to PCRF, many Palestinians are at risk of osteomyelitis, bone infection, following injury if medical treatment is delayed. The dearth of medical resources and restrictions on movement in the besieged strip means that many treatable injuries require amputation. Furthermore, accessing prostheses after amputation was extremely difficult in Gaza even prior to the current hostilities, with only one prosthetic limb center operating in the besieged enclave. In 2018 to 2019, the Zionist regime forces fired at thousands of Palestinians during the Great March of Return protest, killing 214, including 46 children, and injuring over 36,100, including nearly 8,800 children. Over 7,000 of the live ammunition injuries, about 88%, were limb injuries, with amputations required in 156 of these cases. In the aftermath of the assault on the March of Return protesters, the Zionist regime denied most injured protesters' medical permit requests to access specialized treatment in the occupied West Bank, East Al-Quds, and Israeli hospitals. According to Qada Majdi and Hadas Zeev, if the patients had access to this specialized treatment, many amputees could have rescued their limbs. The confirmed Palestinian death toll from ongoing Israeli regime attacks on the Gaza Strip has surged to 21,110, the health ministry in the territory said recently, with 70% of the casualties women and children. An additional 54,536 have also been wounded in the Israeli regime attacks on the besieged enclave.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. And the lines are drawn and it seems crystal clear that either you support genocide or you don't. The U.S. and the U.K. bombed Iraq and Syria on Friday and then Yemen on Saturday. Why? Because these countries or groups in these countries have been standing up against the Israeli regime's genocide of Palestinians. So because they support ending the genocide, these countries are bombed by the U.S.-led group. And, of course, the Zionist entity, which is committing war crimes by the hour, is not only not bombed by the U.S., but continues to get increasing support for its genocide. Will this lead to the end of the Israeli regime, and will it diminish the power of its supporters? Well, stay with us as we look at these questions and more on this Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guest now to the program. Larry Johnson, former CIA analyst out of Bradenton, Florida. And Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst out of Raleigh, North Carolina. Thank you both for being with me. Well, let me start this off in Florida. And Larry, do you think the U.S.'s bombing of Yemen will stop the Yemeni military from supporting the people of Palestine?
No, short answer. It is, you know, the United States and the United Kingdom combined are demonstrating that they're doing the equivalent of punching a bag of Jell-O. Keeps moving around. We don't have any clear idea where the different missiles are. The Houthis have mobile missile systems, so they're very difficult to locate, pin down at any one particular moment. And the fact of the matter is the United States is using very expensive weapon systems to destroy what are relatively inexpensive missile systems. And the Houthis keep developing, you know, demonstrating better and better capability. Just the other day, a U.S. destroyer had to use a Phalanx gun. So this is a gun that's attached to the ship, and it fires at a very rapid rate, almost like a solid sheet of metal coming out. But it's the last line of defense. What this means is that the Houthis fired an anti-ship missile that penetrated every other line of defense, and that was the thing that saved that ship. So I think it's just a matter of time before the Houthis are going to sink one or more of these U.S. or U.K. ships.
Wow, that's interesting. Well, Ray, what about that? You just heard what Larry said. I mean, the last line of defense. I mean, what does that mean when we're talking about a group like Ansar Allah or the Yemeni military being able to stand up or deal with the United States in this manner?
Well, there are people in Washington that just can't believe that we could possibly lose to those people, as they are referred to derisively. I've been around since Vietnam. I know how Averill Harriman and other best and brightest people said we could never lose to those people. We have B-52s and we can bomb them. Well, now we have B-1s, and we can bomb them from Omaha or from New Mexico. We could, you know, our colleague, Douglas McGregor, the colonel, has a wonderful article in the American Conservative today, which harkens back to those days where these woolly-headed academics thought we can work our will in all these places, especially if there are brown feet naked running through the jungle, or in the Houthis case, people who are really obstreperous but beat the combined arms of Saudi Arabia and America over the last 7 years. So this is serious, and as Larry warns, if one ship goes down, well, then this is the problem. Then we will have a casus belli, then we will have a Tonkin Gulf incident, and although most Americans are skeptical of what's going on, our Congress is so much affected and corrupted by the Israel lobby that they will be happy to do what Congress did on misinformation back on in the Tonkin Gulf resolution, mm-hmm. and approve whatever hotheads like Lindsey Graham and others propose. So that's the danger here. Mm-hmm. The Congress is behind this crazy stuff, and it is, after all, an election year.
Right. Yeah, interesting what you said, Ray. It's an election year. And Larry, I mean, the irony of it is that one would think in a so-called civilized society that in an election year that you would definitely want to stand up against genocide. It just seems like it's very, very simplistic, but for some reason, it's so complicated for the United States. Your take on that?
Well, you need to understand, first and foremost, the Palestinians are not real people, okay? They're not human beings. At least that's how it's viewed by members of Congress, the majority of members. So, you know, if you're subhuman, it's easy to kill, just like you step on a bug or kill an insect. I mean, it's shameless. It's shocking. It's horrifying. You know, pick your adjective. But the fact of the matter is, as Ray pointed out, and I'm pleased to be here with my old friend Ray. We show up together. We're like a tag team. The Israeli lobby, it emerged in the mid-1970s. That's when they started buying members of Congress. And they've been buying members of Congress for over 50 years. So Israel has the best government money can buy, but it's not in Israel, it's in the United States. And the United States members, both Republican and Democrat, will support Israel regardless of what Israel does. I mean, hell, you've even got Robert F. Kennedy Jr. shilling for Israel, despite being, you know, he has a long track record of being pro-Palestinian, but by God, he's out describing Hamas as, you know, the reincarnation of the Nazi party and under the control of Adolf Hitler. They need to be exterminated.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned something, Larry, that the Palestinians are not human. And it just took me back to this article in New York Times by Friedman that he talks about. It's unbelievable what he says, and basically that you have to treat these people, whether we're talking about the Houthis or Hezbollah, all these Iranian-backed militias, as he call them, in Syria, you basically treat them because they're part of the animal kingdom. So you have to treat them like that, like bugs. Like, yeah. I mean, it is mind-boggling what we're reading and what we're seeing and describing all of this. And Ray, they get away with it on the one hand, but it does seem that more and more people are actually becoming aware of their game. How do you see it?
Well, I would suggest you referred to Thomas Friedman. He interviewed Tony Blinken about 2 weeks ago. You have to see the video, just 2 minutes of it, and you'll see he asks a question to Blinken, and then Blinken starts talking, and Friedman is one of those bobbing heads. He goes, it's just so apparent. You have to see the visual, okay?
Yeah.
So this is not intractable. The Security Council of the UN is meeting tomorrow, okay? And the U.S. and the U.K. will be in the dock for what they have been doing in terms of attacking Iran-backed. Got to always remember to say Iran-backed militias and so forth in Iraq and Syria. The question is there some sort of tacit agreement not to hit Iran itself? That's big. There seems to be, although Tony Sullivan would not admit to that today during his Meet the Press interview, there's one other really major factor here, and that is Russia and China, which I always advert to because that's what I grew up with, okay? Now, Russia's got a stake here. There's a treaty between Russia and Iran that is just about to be signed and concluded. It includes immense economic benefits for both sides, but also has a military dimension. Okay, now that's one thing. The other thing is that even Jacob Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, recognizes that China has really big interests in what happens in the Persian Gulf and in the Red Sea. And so he trundles off to Singapore to meet with Wang Yi, his counterpart in China, and he says, could you please restrain the Iranians? And, you know, because, you know, we realize you, well, you know, that's pretty pathetic. Wang Yi says, look, knock it off. Realize what the stakes here are and realize that you do not have escalatory dominance several thousand miles away from the United States of America. So it's pretty pathetic. But my point is simply this, that with Chinese economic interests intricately involved here and Russia's treaty obligations to stand by strategically with Iran, which has been approved, by the way, by your supreme leader, the stakes are much higher than they would be otherwise.
Well, Larry, Yemen has said that it will not stop with this blockade of Zionist ships.
Right.
Are those who support the regime. The only way to stop the Yemenis from blocking ships is to end the genocide against the Palestinians. So if Washington really wants to open the sea lanes, all it needs to do is to stop the genocide. Why doesn't it?
Yeah, because it's bought and paid for by Israel. Israel's not going to stop until they exterminate, commit genocide against all Palestinians. They're not interested in saving a single Palestinian life. They want to erase the Palestinians from what they consider to be part Israel. The Gaza Strip is not Palestinian territory as far as this, this ultra extremist faction within the Israeli government is concerned. Ditto for the West Bank. So, yeah, the United States could end this today. All they tell Israel is, okay, you're done. We're not sending you another dime. We're not going to come to your aid militarily if you're in trouble. We're not giving you another shell or piece of ammunition. Stop it. And Israel would be compelled to stop. But, you know, we continue to enable them. We're like that ultimate drug pusher that is giving somebody all the crack cocaine they want, and regardless of what it's doing to them or to other people.
Ray, your thoughts? Go ahead.
Yeah, I think Larry is absolutely right. And when the International Court of Justice all but accused Israel of overt genocide, the result on the part of Israel was not surprising. Israel kept genociding the Palestinians in Gaza. The reaction of the United States, I confess I was surprised. They stopped funding the only UN agency that could help prevent genocide. Yeah. The one that brings food, the one that water and all kinds of other help that could prevent those Palestinians that are lucky enough to get out from under the rubble, okay? Well, what do they have to look forward to? Starvation. Why? Because the Israelis made up a story about a couple of UN employees that were helping Hamas, okay? They came down, six of them out of 26,000. And so the U.S. said, oh, we got to cut off aid. And so did all these vassals of the U.S. cut off aid to UNRWA. Now, that's going to cause starvation before the Israelis are able to kill the rest of the Palestinians in Gaza.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
End of the day, Larry, many people would say, what does the United States get out of this? Many of the Congress people have been bought and paid for by the Israeli regime. But obviously, when we see the stance that the United States has taken with this genocide, and we see reactions from the majority of the world, many parts of the world, it's not in the U.S.'s benefit, if you want to say we want to look at it from a PR perspective. It tries to show itself as a protector of liberty and freedom and all of that. So your take, Larry.
Well, look, your problem is you're entirely too rational and logical, okay? Remember, you're a woman. You're supposed to be illogical and irrational. So you're looking ahead to think that the United States has said, oh, what's in our interest so that the world will like us and we can have influence in the world? They don't care. That's the thing people need to understand. This is all about Israel's control of the Congress. They're bought and paid for. And layered in there are these very conservative Christian organizations that believe that this is a sign from God, that these are the end of times, and that all we're waiting, ginning up the Battle of Armageddon so that Jesus will return. That's another element in this. You know, people don't like to talk about that in, you know, in news programs and such. But, you know, you're absolutely right. If the United States was thinking rationally, they say, look, we are losing influence around the world. Our reputation is severely damaged. Countries that used to rely upon, that we could rely upon, like Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and Jordan, they're starting to distance themselves, and they're starting to act on their own without regard to what we want. And so it's a very dangerous time to be a U.S. citizen overseas, because I think the prestige that the United States once enjoyed, I think it's irretrievably lost.
Ray, you wanted to say something? Go ahead.
Yeah, I would just to say this in an apocryphal kind of way. Last week, when Larry Johnson and I were on CNN, we explained all this to the American people.
Yeah.
Larry Johnson and I are not on CNN.
Yeah, I'm sure
we
not.
We will never again be on CNN because right. we have the wrong information or happens to be the accurate, true information, okay? I say that in a jocular way, but it goes to the bedrock here. Most Americans are good people. They're like the star of other nations and other peoples to death, but they don't know what's going on. And so Larry and I are happy to come on any program like yours to explain how we come at this, but we're not giving a voice. We're not giving a voice in the mainstream media in the United States. That is a supreme problem. We keep working on it, and I think gradually we're making some progress. And, you know, as clever people like the Russians and like the Iranians, choose attrition, a gradualist approach to work at their objectives, then they avoid giving the United States an obvious pretext to go directly after Russia on the one hand or after Iran on the other. I'd add one more thing. Nobody knows that the chief of the Iranian National Security Council met together with Patrushev, his Russian counterpart, just 3 weeks ago in Moscow. And they reached an agreement on the kinds of things that national security advisors reach agreement on. So that tie is getting even closer. Our people don't know that. And I wonder if even Sullivan and Blinken are aware of that.
Hmm. Well, Larry, how would you assess the... not only the Yemeni military, but if we look at this resistance front in general, as far as their performance since October the 7th, where we're talking about Hezbollah in Lebanon that, of course, has continued to attack the Israeli regime, and, of course, the northern parts of the occupied territories have had to the settlers have had to leave from there. Right. Or we're talking about the Yemenis, or we're talking about the Iraqis, the Syrians. Your overall assessment of this?
Well, number one, Yemen is one of only two countries that's really taking concrete steps to fight back against Israel. Yemen's done it by blocking the Red Sea and effectively blocking it from all traffic related to Israel that would be going to or from Israel. And now it includes both U.S. and U.K. vessels. And they continue to shut it down despite the efforts of the United States and U.K. to bomb them into submission. They're not going to submit. The other country, South Africa, by virtue of bringing the case that it did. The rest of the countries in the Middle East, in my view, have been largely playing lip service but not doing what they could do. For example, Turkey in particular. Turkey could cut off the oil flow to Israel. Same for Jordan. And they're not doing it. And now we've got the United States, who claims to be the upholder of this rules-based international order, acting illegally in Syria and in Iraq. I mean, for God's sake, they're carrying out unilateral military strikes inside the sovereign territory of Iraq without consulting with the Iraqis. And so one of these days, these people, you know, the citizens and the leaders of these countries have got to stand up and tell the United States enough. I mean, we're like a junkie, an alcoholic that needs an intervention. We can't help ourselves.
Yeah, well, I think the resistance is trying to actually intervene and help in that way. Well, Ray, go ahead. You wanted to say something.
Yeah, I'll just say that it's a supreme irony that the little, so-called little hoochies on the side of international justice in this issue, the International Court of Justice and the Houthis are joined together in pursuing justice against genocide, for God's sake. And all our president would have to do is call up the Israeli leaders and say, look, enough. You don't get any more arms. You don't get any more political support. We're even going to help UNRWA supply food and medicine and water unless you stop. That's all it would take. So rules-based international order, give me a break. That's a fraud. That's a fraud, as Larry mentioned. But the UN is coming into its own now. And the U.S. is totally isolated with its vassal, the U.K. It's going to be interesting tomorrow what happens at the Security Council.
And on that note, I thank both of you for being with me on the spotlight. Larry Johnson, former CIA analyst out of Florida. Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst out of North Carolina. Thank you for being with us on another spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing off for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering your doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman, Allah, who is Al-Mannan. La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Very welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atar, the host of this program. We have a special guest speaker from the Islamic House of Qom, Sayyid Zain. Assalamu alaikum, Sayyid. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Okay, Sayyid Zain, for today's discussion, we want to talk about an interesting topic. We know that in Islam, and according to Islamic teachings, the good doers will go to the heavens, to the Jannah of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. This is an authentic and certain promise given by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that those who abstain from evil actions and do righteous actions will go to the heavens. There are some obligations and there are some behaviors to be done. And generally, you must be a good person to go to the heavens as a Muslim. But there are also some people during the history of the world who were not believing in a religion, or they were not following any Abrahamic religion, or they were not Muslims, for example, in general, but they were good people. They served the humanity. They invented something that facilitated the life, for example, a medication, a medicine, for example, Alexander Fleming, penicillin, for example, okay, antibiotic. Or, for example, those who invented the wheel, or those who invented the electricity, or they discovered, you know, new things that facilitated it. And today we could see that even so many believing population of the world, whether Muslim or non-Muslims, are benefiting from these ni'mah of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, which were discovered by these people. What about the destiny of such people? Do they go to the same heavens as the believing ones or not?
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. First and foremost, it's difficult for us to say exactly who will make it to heaven and who will not make it to heaven. Yes, you know, the believers who are pure believers,
yes,
and they're really high levels, they'll go to heaven. The disbelievers who are, you know, corrupt and refusing the truth and fighting against the truth,
yes,
okay, they'll go to hell. But everyone else in the middle, it's difficult for us to say, you know, whether they will be allowed into heaven or not, right? Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala knows them better. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala knows their intentions, what kind of opportunities they were given, and did they accept and act according to those opportunities or not. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala knows that best, and obviously it's up to him to decide. So now these people, the individuals that you mentioned, it's possible that they make it to heaven, even though they weren't Muslims, right? Perhaps if they believed in another religion of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, Ahl Kitab, Christians, yes, or Jews, yes, yes. I'm not sure if these individuals were like that or not, but mm-hmm. most likely I think they were Christian.
Yes.
Perhaps if they, you know, if Islam didn't reach them, they didn't hear about it properly. And whatever they heard of the other religions of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, they accepted it and acted according to it.
Yes.
Then, you know, it's completely likely that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will, you know, send them to heaven as well.
Mm-hmm.
So then the conditions for heaven would be this, that the truth that comes to a person accepts that and brings that into his or her life as well and acts according to that truth.
That's right.
Now that truth, part of it is from religions,
yes.
right? So part of it is from within ourselves as well.
Yes.
Right? So somebody now who's living in, you know, the forests, you know, far away, they don't have any contact with any other religion or anything
yes.
like that.
Yes.
They still have their fitrah, they have their human yes. nature, the God-given nature, which calls them towards Tawheed, which calls uh-huh. them towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now, if they accept that and act according to that
yes.
and the goodness that they understand in their own selves, they bring that into their lives,
yes.
Then, you know, inshallah, Allah's forgiveness and His mercy is there for them as well. Inshallah, okay. they'll make it to heaven too.
Yes.
So now it's not just Muslims who'll make it to heaven.
Yes.
It can be other people as well. But somebody who does the truth reaches their ears,
yes.
they understand the truth,
yes.
and they take a stand against it, yes. they don't accept it, that's a different case now.
Okay. And is it at all true to judge a person by his inventions or discoveries? I mean, for example, there are some people who had great discoveries, but when you take a look at their personal life, they violated the rights of the others, or for example, they did sinning, drinking liquors, I don't know, doing adultery, or this and that, mm-hmm. killing so many people. Okay, they were scientists too. Mm-hmm.
So if a good action is done based on good intentions,
uh-huh.
right, then Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is not such that He will let that go.
Uh-huh.
Right. So there would be some kind of recompense for that. Now, uh-huh. is that sufficient for them to go to heaven
yes.
or not? You know,
but that's as a compensation for the other sins, it will work, isn't it?
Possibly.
Okay,
right.
possibly.
It's